Welcome back to this weekly meeting of the Community Planning and Housing Committee with Denver City Council. Your Community Planning and Housing Committee starts now.
We have a pretty packed agenda, so we'll get it rolling. I'm Sarah Parity, one of your council members at large, and I will go to my left, Council President.
Oh, thank you. Amanda Sandoval, Northwest Denver District 1.
Correct, Amanda.
Good afternoon. Diana Romero Campbell, Southeast Denver District 4.
Chantel Lewis, District 8, and Sawyer is online.
Hi, Flora Luitres, Lucky District 7.
Jamie Torres, West Denver District 3.
And to our member online. All right. And with that, our first item today, we have two action items. The first one is 25-1082, the Kappa building loan agreement, which we moved off the consent agenda last week. So host, if you guys want to take it away and introduce yourselves too.
Thank you. Hello. Thanks for having us today. My name is Autumn Bueller. I'm an asset manager in the Housing Stability Department.
I'm Maureen Morley, and I'm the Director of Asset Management and Compliance and Housing Stability.
Great. Thank you both for being here on this.
Oh, you're on the screen. Well,
the slide
we
should come
are
up
here.
Any moment, but
thank
yeah.
You. So we're here to present on Kappa Tower 2 and 3. I'm just going to say both of them together. And oh, we've got it up.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm just going to go over the project as we understand some questions came up, and so hopefully I can answer them for you today. So I'm just going to do just a brief introduction so that you're familiar with the project, starting with Kappa Tower 2. Aren't familiar, it's located in District 8 off of Northfield Boulevard in Central Park at 9020 East Northfield Boulevard. And it was funded with $700,000 using our affordable housing permanent funds closed back in July of 2020. This was used just to fund the project for the development of affordable senior housing. And the project contains 70 units, all affordable. We have 18 units at 60%, 27 at 50, 18 at 40, and 7 at 30 for a covenant period of not less than 60 years. And it's set up on a cash flow payment loan. If you want to go ahead and go to the next slide, I'll just cover a little bit about Kappa Tower 2. On the next slide, there's an image that I can share with you, but I just wanted to explain that Kappa Tower 2 was developed with a portion of the lot being vacant with plans for future development of Kappa Tower 3 for additional senior housing. However, because that language was not included in the actual loan agreement, we had to come to you to do an amendment so that we could allow for the future development of Kappa Tower 3 for that to move forward. And so you can see from the image up here, the area highlighted in yellow is the vacant area that we were looking to come to City Council for release on so that we could develop that into what is being called Kappa Tower 3 for additional senior housing. And just a little bit more information on what Kappa Tower 3 will be. Thank you. Again, additional senior housing. So we're going to be funding $1,050,000 using our linkage fee fund. That will be coming to you in August for approval. So you'll be seeing this soon. And so knowing that, I came to you ahead of time for the request on the release to allow for the development. And just wanting to reiterate that this will be for just specifically senior housing. It will provide 30 additional units. We will have 12 at 50% AMI, 9 at 40, and another 9 at 30% with another 60 years added. And so by allowing us to do a partial release of the covenant on Kappa Tower 2, we will be then putting another covenant on that vacant land with Kappa Tower 3. So that kind of gives you answers, or hopefully answers any questions that you have about the project in general. And then I wanted to just come to you today to hopefully answer any other questions or concerns that you had, just because I wanted to put this together and provide it to you, but didn't have a lot of information on what the questions were. So tried to get as much information as we could as possible and provide that information to you, but perhaps I can see if there's still questions that are coming up.
Yeah, no, thank you for the overview, and we'll open the queue with Councilmember Lewis, since it's her district.
Okay, yeah,
and anyone else in queue, let me know. If it wants to get in queue, let me know.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for taking the time to give this presentation. So yeah, 2 and 3 are both in my district, and so I really appreciate this. We're following this closely. We attend regularly the
Resident Council.
Thank you.
Yeah, that one.
The Resident Council.
Very active pretty, Resident Council.
They thing. Do. You know this. And so heard from the residents and just want to make sure that we're putting things in place to make sure that this is mutually beneficial for the folks who live there and then also the future tenants as well. And so really appreciate that these are affordable housing opportunities for those that live there, but also want to make sure that I'm co-governing with the Residents Council because they are quite active.
Yeah.
So I don't have any questions based on your presentation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Does anyone else want to get in queue? Because I do have some questions, but okay, great. Yeah, so on that, the topic of resident councils has been really interesting because we see some affordable developments where those really take off and are successful, and some where they kind of struggle. That's normal with anything that involves human beings. But I would be really curious to hear a little bit more about the success at Kappa 2 since we're here and have you guys.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I think one of the things with Kappa 2 is that they've leased up quickly, they've stabilized, they've kept their occupancy where other affordable properties in Denver have struggled a little bit at the 60% AMI, and they've been able to stabilize and keep that. And Silva Partners have done a wonderful job at managing it and working with the Resident Council. It's supposed to be a collaborative conversation with the Resident Council and management so that they can support each other back and forth. And I think that they've got communication going really well. They've taken steps to make sure that the parking lot was had additional eyes on it, so they haven't had a break-in in over 9 months. And so a lot of those concerns they're working with very, very closely. And we did bring a representative from the management if you needed any additional questions.
You stole the words right out of my mouth. I would love to talk to someone from Silva Partners, and whoever's here and wants to answer a couple of questions, I'll ask the question first so you know what it's about, and then you can come up to the mic and introduce yourself. Really, it's just the same thing I asked. I would love to hear more about how you have supported your resident council.
Get back in the queue.
Hi. So my name is Adrian Leha. I'm the VP of Operations for Silva Management.
Thank you for coming.
Yes, you're welcome. Thank you for inviting.
And feel free to introduce the rest of the team if you'd like to, so we know who's here.
Okay. Larry Williams is with Kappa Housing Inc. I'm part of the board.
Don Bookart.
I just met Don, and then Josh from Medici, who's the development.
Great, thank you.
Yes, so we attend every, or try to attend every resident council meeting, but we do take what they say to heart. We know that it's a give and take. We have to listen, we also have to give. Some of the stuff that they have given us, we have fixed, mediated. We've had to, you know, if you get a lot of people in the room, you're going to get a lot of different things that want to be done and need to be done now. And we try our hardest to get to those as many as we can, and trying to fix what we need to fix, trying to alleviate a lot of the questions that they might even have. I know there's been questions about the parking lot, about different things like that. And so we've tried our hardest to let them know that some of the things we can't do, but we would escalate that, talk to someone, see what needs to happen, and that's how we work on that part of it.
What other properties do you manage?
So we manage about 32 properties across Denver Metro, and then we also have some in Gunnison, Colorado Springs, Durango, Longmont, so a wide range of different properties around. We do also have, I think it's 2 or 3 more senior housing properties in Denver Metro, so we do quite a bit of work in especially the affordable. That's our niche, is the affordable housing.
Okay, well, thank you so much for answering that. Anybody else have a burning question? Councilmember Lewis.
Yes, because I didn't realize that you all were here, so I really appreciate you all attending. I have a few that we've heard directly from the Residents Council and from members who live in Capo Taros in general regarding issue with rent, where they were previously able to be able to give checks or money orders in order to be able to pay their rents, and now it has shifted into having to pay online, and many of the seniors have expressed challenges and difficulties being able to work that technology, which has caused some troubles in their lives. And so I wanted to inquire about that.
Yeah, so we did do a switch over from our software company. Our previous software company did offer the portal, but we also were able to accept checks and money orders. We shifted to a brand new one, started July 1st. That one is a little bit more online. We found that we've had, and not specifically at Capo, but some of our other properties had issues with stolen checks, stolen money orders, different things like that. So this was a safety feature in our eyes that we would be able to offer this to them to pay online. So that way it's a little bit more convenient for them. We do understand that some people do not have the necessary equipment or anything that they might need to continue to do a money order or a check. We are looking into integrating that somehow, but there is other ways for them to do it, not having to do it online. They can also, which I know can be a little bit inconvenient, but they can also go to like any 7-Eleven, Walgreens, and do an e-money order, and all it costs is the same that they would if they bought a money order, and it automatically will go to their portal as well. So there's other things, but we are working on that, trying to get a scanner in place in order for us to go ahead and accept some of those as well. And our manager is always willing to help if someone does have issues with the software. It's just, that one's kind of iffy because then you're getting their personal information to put in the portal for them, and that can get kind of, so we try to stay away from that, but we're willing to help any way that we can, especially our managers.
A few follow-ups.
Yeah.
When you say you're willing to help, tell me what that means, because when I hear the residents say that it's actually an inconvenience and it's a challenge and it makes it harder for them to be able to pay their rents, and I hear you saying that it's a convenience, it feels like there's a discrepancy.
Right. I think a lot of things is just education and helping them to see what the good part of it is. The good part is that it does automatically go from your checking account into to pay your rent. You can do auto pay, so it automatically does that every month. But again, our managers are instructed to help anybody that needs help. So if they have questions on how to get in, you can get in with your phone, with your cell phone. You don't need a computer. If you have a computer, laptop, cell phone, any of those instruments, you're able to get into the portal, which means that you can log in and get that necessary stuff that needs to happen to do that part of it. We also do, we are getting computers or tablets for the area for residents if they do need that part of it. So that way they can access on the computer, I'll say lab, but there's not a specific lab for it, but a computer or tablet in order to be able to do that if they do not have cell phone, computer, or anything like that to get on there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So give me a few. Talk to me about the timeline for each of these things that you've just detailed. When are the scanners supposed to be installed? When are the computers going to be installed? How often will they have access to someone who can train them on the technology? Because we're talking about seniors in our communities who didn't grow up with this technology.
Yes.
And I'm empathetic to that they're asking for something that makes it actually easy for them. And I think generationally we are giving something that is more convenient for us, but it's actually not more convenient for them.
Right.
Talk to me about these.
Yeah, so I want to say that the scanners, I know we ordered them, so it should be here anytime. So we're hoping that we would be able to hook them up. The software that we moved to does not support scanners so much. So, excuse me, I'm sorry. So it's one of those things that we have to integrate with IT in order to get that fixed and going. So, I mean, I would say we just switched over in July 1st. So we told everybody until September 1st was our drop dead date where everything would be flowing well. I'm not saying perfect, but well. As far as a laptop, computer, or tablet, we could do that at any time. I think we were just waiting to see what the. As far as I'm aware, we've not received any kickback that is what's needed for someone to come and do that. Again, I just have not heard anything, so I don't want to say that what you're saying is not true by any means. I just have not heard that personally myself on any of my emails or anything that's going on with the property itself.
Can I just interrupt you momentarily? How often do you attend the residence council meetings?
So personally,
because I've gone and they say it at every single meeting.
Personally, I have not gone. I just started.
That's why you haven't heard it.
Right, well, I am on a lot of emails though that have to do with Kappa. So I'm just saying I have not heard anything because of emails coming to me. I've not attended. Our CEO is the one who attends most of the meetings, or our COO. I have to apologize. I have not heard it only because you might be correct that I just have not been there.
No, I'm correct.
But I just have not received any emails as well on anything for that as well. So, again, we're always there. We're always willing to help. I have a manager on site that has been there for years, and she's always willing to help anybody that needs help. And again, accessing even on her computer to let them get on there to be able to do that if that's something that they need to.
If you would like to add to that, please feel free to introduce yourself and speak.
Sorry. No, that's fine. Okay. No, you were fine.
Right. My name is Larry Williams. I'm chairman of the board of Kappa Housing. Well, to answer your question, we have a computer lab at Kappa Tower 2, Kappa Tower 1 also. And there's a couple computers in there. The tenants can use them anytime. They're available, and they're in a private area. So it's not like a group meeting like this. There's a private area. So if any of them are interested, we talk to our service coordinator about teaching them how to use the computer and how to do these things. That's where we're headed towards.
That's it. Thank you, Larry. I really appreciate that. That's exactly what I want to know is how often are those classes offered in order for them to learn the technology, because the struggle is that they haven't been trained on the technology, and so thus the technology is an advancement, but it's actually not for them because they don't know how to operate it, and it's caused them challenges to be able to pay their rent.
I would agree with you on that. The computers are available. We're always looking for people to come in.
Not availability. When are people actually in the computer labs teaching them how to work the technology?
I'm going to finish saying.
My apologies.
We're always looking for people to teach them how to use the computers, how to help them get their tax refunds and other things. So if anybody brings this issue to the service coordinator, they usually come up with some resources to help them. Another thing, that the ones that have bank accounts, you can have your mortgage payment, your rent payment paid right out of your checking or savings account every month. And you don't have any issues. So that's another option. And anytime that we're like, if we see information about people being scammed, we tell them or suggest to them solutions how to solve those problems. And you see people, one gentleman, I was walking down the hall, and he was rushing, and I said, "What's going on?" He says, "I got a letter from about toll driving, and I owe him a fine. And I don't know what to do because I gave him my bank account." I said, "Well, you know, you got to look at A, B, C, and D, and that, you know, give anybody your bank account." So when we see classes that are being offered or information, we put those on bulletin boards so that we can get someone in to teach those subjects. But we know it's ongoing, and we try to help them as they progress.
In summary, the answer is, to my question, you all don't have classes regularly to teach them the technology. So if I'm inquiring and telling you that the residents are having challenges with the introduction of this new technology, and you have still not told me we have a computer tech class every Tuesday at 3:00, it doesn't answer my question. Well, so what I'm hearing is that you're looking for providers to be able to offer that, but you don't currently have that in place.
No, we don't.
And thus the residents are going to continue to suffer this challenge that they have already uplifted, not just as our council office, but to you all as well, because you don't actually have a program in place to address.
No, we don't have a program. This program started, as I understand it, on July. And this is August 1st, 1 month. So there's some bugs to be worked out, but we're still helping the tenants get their needs taken care of. So, I mean,
Up here. What's July? Because you two just gave different answers.
July 1st was when we switched over to the new property management software.
Correct. Yes. Not to the programming to teach them the software.
Not to teach them the software.
Yes.
But in the interim period with the service coordinator, I believe, I can't say for sure, but if any tenant goes in and tells
them. You don't want to tell me if you don't know for sure.
Well, what I don't know all the conversations that take place, council person, a woman person, I'm sorry.
Whatever, it's cool.
But what I'm saying is if a tenant goes in and says, I'm having trouble getting my income tax, my rebate check, I've heard the service coordinator say, okay, let's go online and solve this problem. Whatever problem you have, let's see if we can fix it. So I agree with you, maybe the classes have not started, but that doesn't mean we're not looking for people who can come in to qualify and teach our tenants how to operate the system.
Larry, if it's not time bound, then it's not going to happen. So you can come to me same time next year and say, we're still looking, versus these are the active steps that we are taking to put it in place. You all, I assume, had a time bound goal to be able to put the software in place. And you met that goal. July is when you put it in place. So you should also have a goal to put that program or the programming in place, because your residents are telling you that they cannot pay their rents and it's a hassle because they don't know how to work the technology.
Let's qualify that for a second. The residents don't tell me about their rent.
They tell me. They call me. That's why I'm talking to you about it.
I don't deal with their money at all, but I deal with problems with the building. So my point is, we're looking, even though I hear this, I'm going to go back and I'm going to try to help the property manager find somebody to solve the problem. It's not like we're ignoring it, but we're just trying to help them, and that's why we offer different classes on occasion for the tenants, whatever the needs they may have, that we can find somebody to solve it. When it's tax time in April, we find somebody or some group to come in and help them file their taxes to get their refunds. So whatever, there might not be a person today, but that doesn't mean we're not looking for somebody to solve and help them with that problem.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else have a follow-up question? Okay.
I do have a follow-up question. My question is just, can people not just take a check and go pay their rent, somewhere? Do they have to use this electronic system? Yes, please.
So right now, the software does not allow us to do checks like before. So you can do a e-money order, or you can sign up and you can do an ACH payment online. And I think that's where the questions are coming from, because of that being online part of it.
Okay.
So right now, we're not accepting checks, but we are going to be. So.
Well, I'm glad you're going to be. I would say that sounds very stressful to me as a millennial, and I have to help my parents all the time with these things.
Me too.
and having automatic payments doesn't work for everybody, especially if you don't, your check is late or it's not enough and you have to choose between food and rent and you're trying to figure that out. So I just want to highlight that does sound like a really big issue and definitely want to see that get resolved.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else in queue? Because I now have one more question myself. Okay. I couldn't tell, Council President. Yeah, so my follow-up question to that would just be, have folks been charged late fees when they've been unable?
No.
Okay. Have they been charged?
No, we all late fees because of this. The new software coming up, so all late fees have been waived at this time.
Okay. I just was curious if anyone has seen a late fee come through, even if it's then been removed, which is good, but...
They should not, and if they have, then they just need to let us know. We'll take it off right away, but as far as I'm aware, the last email we sent out was no late fees for anybody because of the software change.
Okay. All right, one more pause for questions, and then we either need a motion to move it to the floor or another motion if there is one.
Can I ask one more follow-up?
Of course.
Please, sorry.
We have about 5 minutes left on this item.
Does that include late fees that were assessed when the new system was put in place?
So it was late fees starting for July 1st because of the new system.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because there were fees in January or February. So anything previous to...
Right. So if they were late January, February, and they had late fees already on there, that wasn't removed. It was just we were forgiven the July ones because of the software update.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
I'm happy to put this to the full body, but I am definitely going to be watching it closely because these are our seniors in our community. They're vulnerable populations. They are, when we hear from them, they've already been super vulnerable where people are preying on them in parking lots, still in their cars. Like, now there's just this like one extra thing. We've had conversations already in council about the increases to their rents when they have are reliant on fixed incomes. Like, we just gotta do a better job of taking care of our seniors, and I don't feel that in this moment. And if my grandmother says she wants to write a check, let her write a check.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I'm not gonna write a check, but if my grandmother wants to, they should have the opportunity to do so. And so thank you all for being here. Thank you all so much.
Okay. Yeah, thank you so much. And I couldn't tell, Councilmember Lewis says, do you wanna make a motion?
No, it's fine, you can. You
okay.
Can, yeah.
Do I have a motion to move it to the floor?
Motion.
Great. Moved by Torres, seconded by Romero Campbell. Do we need a voice vote at all or a thumbs up?
No.
Okay.
I'm good.
Can I get thumbs ups to move to the floor?
Yep.
Thanks, guys. So formal. All right. Thank you very much. That was super helpful. And I just, I appreciate having a presentation where we are able to talk about an individual building and hope we'll be able to do more of that in this committee now that we have a little more space and not so many agencies rolling up. Second action item, and thank you so much to the folks from Host.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Second action item is something. It's a rezoning at 4626 East Louisiana Avenue. Edson, thank you so much. You're getting a lot of us this week.
Yeah.
And I don't have a note on whose council district that is, and being at large, I don't, it's Cashman, yeah. Okay. Whenever you're ready, Edson, go for it.
Good afternoon. My name is Edson Ibanez with CPD. Before you today, we have a rezoning application at 4626 East Louisiana Avenue. The request is to go from a single unit zone district to a row house up to 2.5 stories in height. So I'll go through the request. We'll look at the location and context. We'll discuss the process and look at the review criteria. So the request, like I mentioned, is suburban row house up to 2.5 stories. The site itself is a single family residence, so it has a home that's about two stories. And the site is 24,000, just slightly above 24,000 square feet, so a little over half an acre. And so looking at the location and context, it's located in Council District 6 in Cashman's district. And highlighted here in red, it's in the Virginia Village neighborhood. So like I mentioned, the site itself is zone SUD, which is our single unit zone district that has a minimum lot size of 6,000 square feet. Everything to the south of the site is single unit, which is predominantly single family houses, but it's sandwiched between the SRH 2.5, which is what's being requested here. The SRH 2.5 is that row house up to 2.5 stories. To the north of the site, we have SMU3, which is our multi-unit up to three stories, and then kind of to that southwest there, you have some SMS5, which is the multi-unit up to five stories. So when you look at the land use that we get from our assessor's records, the site is single family, but it's sandwiched between multifamily, and then to the north we have apartment complexes, which is multi-unit, and then everything to the south is single family residential. So the site, it's kind of hard to see here on this image, it's on the top right corner. It is a two-story single family house. Directly to the west of the site, we see some kind of townhomes that range between one and two stories. And then to the north of the site is the upper right photo is the apartment complex, which is five stories. And then to the south of the site is predominantly one story single family houses. So now looking at the process. So an informational notice was sent out in April of this year. The application was revised. So originally the application was for SMU 3, which is that multi-unit up to three stories. And then the applicant revised their application and submitted for a new rezone district, which is that SRH 2.5 now. So that was revised back in June. It went before the planning board in July of 16th, and it's before you today, and it's tentatively scheduled to go to full City Council public hearing on August 15th. To date, we've received one letter of support from the East Evans Business Association, RNO. With that, we also received a letter of support, and we've received one letter of opposition and two letters of concerns. Those opposition and concern statements that we received were all mainly on the SMU3. They were concerned about three stories. They were concerned about apartments specifically, and you know, most of it was saying we want to see it consistent with what's on the south side rather than the north side. So that's where the applicant revised their application to an SRH 2.5. And so with that, you know, now we're going to jump into the review criteria. So every rezoning has to follow the Denver Zoning Code's criteria that's spelled out, which are consistency with adopted plans, public interest, and consistency with neighbor context, zone district purpose, and intent statements. And so this specific application falls under three adopted plans, which is Comprehensive Plan 2040, Blueprint Denver of 2019, and the Near Southeast Area Plan of 2023. So there's multiple strategies that this specific application falls under, but I just wanted to highlight a few here under equity goals, such as the equitable, affordable, and inclusive goal two, strategy A, create a greater mix of housing options in every neighborhood for all individuals, as well as encourage quality infill development that's consistent with the surrounding neighborhood and offers opportunities for increased amenities. And under climate goals, promote infill development where infrastructures and services are already in place. When we jump into Blueprint Denver, Blueprint Denver classifies this area as suburban. Suburban is more of homes that are largely single unit, but it can include higher intensity residential. When we look at the place type, it's classified as low medium residential. So low medium is a mix of low to mid-scale multi-unit residential options, so small-scale multi-unit buildings with heights up to three stories. So this applicant is applying for 2.5 stories in height. And then Louisiana Avenue is a residential collector. Within the growth area strategy, it's classified as all other areas within the city. So we anticipate to see 20% of new housing growth and 10% of new closing growth by 2040. Additionally, you know, the small scale rezoning can help implement the equity goals, such as housing goal two, diversify housing options by exploring opportunities to integrate missing middle into low and low medium residential areas. And then for climate goals, reduce climate impacts by multi-unit buildings are more energy efficient than low scale density residential development types. When we jump into the near southeast area plan, this is an area that had a place type designation change. So it was originally low, but it was changed to low medium. And so low medium places with and it has a recommendation of 2.5 stories in height. And so in the residential low medium place type within 2.5 stories, the maximum height recommendation of appropriate housing types should be duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, and townhomes, which are the building forms that are allowed under the SRH 2.5. Additionally, there's a strategy in the land use recommendation 6B2 that talks about introduce missing middle housing types in designated places adjacent to corridors, creating transitions areas that scale down intensity from corridors into surrounding residential neighborhoods, and then that limit rezonings in newly designated places until design requirements have been updated. So I think this site is very unique in the sense that it's already sandwiched between SRH 2.5, so it's looking for that same zone designation. And additionally, we have that SMU3 and SMU5 directly to the north, just north of Louisiana. So it's providing that transition to the lower residential to south, and it's row houses. So it's not the townhomes that can be built here. It's row houses that all the front doors have to be facing the primary street, which would be Louisiana here. And so it's very unique in the surrounding area, and this will facilitate development that's consistent with the surrounding area already. It's consistent with the public interest as it's consistent with Blueprint Denver and the small area plan for low medium, where we want to see small multi-unit up to 2.5 stories in height. And it's consistent with the neighborhood context, zone district purpose, and intent statement as specified in the staff report. Therefore, CPD recommends approval of that based that all the findings of the review criteria have been met. I'm available for any questions. the applicants here for any questions as well. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. It's Councilmember Cashman's district. He's not on this committee, so anybody else have any questions? Councilmember Torres.
Thank you. Thank you, Edson. Is the applicant available?
Sure. Yep.
Hi.
Hi.
If you can just introduce yourself.
My name is Howard Kent. I'm an architect, and I represent the landowner, Dur Az Aziz.
Okay. Thank you, Howard. There's a little tiny slot out at the top of the property, and I was just looking at a Google map, and there's a little tiny structure on it. What is that?
It used to be Public Service Company. We now know it as XL. They have a gas valve there. It occupies a 20-foot by 50-foot piece of land that was obviously cut out of the old farmland previously. And I would love for them to abandon it and give the land to the client, but I don't see that happening.
Got it. So it's still a used
Yes.
parcel.
Yes.
Okay.
It makes sounds now.
Okay. RH 2.5, what do you anticipate the property owner doing with the property? Because it's a huge lot.
Yeah.
And I'm noticing a couple different uses to the sides of you that use RH 2.5 in different ways. Some have narrowed, like a more narrow lot where they've broken it up. Others have a much bigger space. Do you know if there are plans in play?
There aren't plans in place. What there are is some various site studies that I did. The owner is a, I'll tell you straight up, he's an immigrant from Pakistan who's a dentist. And so he's not a professional developer. He bought the house and the little farm piece, but he realizes that it's not its best use. So he brought me on to investigate what we could do with it. I would think that it's going to be townhouses, row houses type. Given the density on either side of it, it's going to be somewhere in the 8 to 10 units, maybe, you know, given what they have. It you could develop it differently if it weren't for that piece that's cut out of it, because there's a limitation on frontage. Because there's a limitation on the road frontage, you are actually limited by access and number of units. But we haven't investigated an actual design, and I'm not so sure that he won't just sell this to someone else. Well, you know, he's already weathered this process, and it's been okay for him, but he may just sell it with the new zoning.
Does he live on site?
Yes, he does.
Okay, got it. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Edson, just for you, the building forms that could be used here, RH 2.5, row home, duplex, single family home?
Mm-hmm, correct.
Okay, all right, thank you. Thank you.
Have a great time. Yeah, thank you, Councilmember. Anybody else?
Sawyer online.
Oh, I see. Okay, great. Councilmember Sawyer, Eagle Eye Pro Tem spotted your little hand raising on the corner of the screen there. It is all you.
I was just about to Teams you and say, I have a question. So thank you. Just a question for, I think, the architect. One of the conversations that we had during the creation of the Near Southeast Area Plan was a conversation around affordability. And the concern that in these areas where there are now single family homes that are quote unquote attainable, right, for, you know, first time home buyers or young families, et cetera, we see that they're being scraped, and then there are either McMansions being built in those locations. So what was once a $750,000 home is now a, you know, $2.2 million McMansion. Or we see potential rezonings coming through where, you know, what was once a single family home is being scraped and, you know, 8 townhouses are being put there. And so, but the pricing on those townhouses is not sort of equivalent to the original cost of the land. And so the challenge there is that what that does is it accelerates gentrification and displacement of residents. And because our kind of near Southeast area is one of the places where there's still a significant amount of attainable housing. The council members who worked in that district were very clear about our concern of scraping and rebuilding and sort of creating this gentrification problem or continuing this gentrification problem that we see all over the city. And we've seen this happen in a number of neighborhoods. We've seen it happen in Sunnyside. We've seen it happen in Cherry Creek, et cetera. And it's definitely in the best interest of the city to ensure that we don't do that. I know that there is a city process that is happening right now in community planning and development, looking at unlocking some of these different affordability issues that might address some of this displacement. And I'm curious whether that is something that the property owner has had conversations with CPD about in this rezoning, because this is exactly the situation that we're talking about.
Is that on me? So the conversations I've had with the owner is he's done a real estate investigation, and this is about two blocks south of Glendale. This is not a high end district. We talked about making affordable housing with it. By what I mean affordable, I do not mean necessarily Section 8 or real low income housing, but more middle class housing.
Yeah, that's what we call like attainable housing. Okay. Right, that's the word that we use because people get confused when you say affordable housing is a deed-restricted affordable housing. Or do
He believes the target audience is more of a middle-class audience. If you look at what's been built on either side of it, we don't want to be the most expensive property on the street. Now, having said that, I won't be able to control what happens to this zoning should he sell it. So the zoning is to match the zoning that's on either side of it. The current owner has no interest in doing real high-end housing. He wants to be able to move it, but he's not sure he will pursue that way. Across the street is a five-story apartment building. On either side of it are multi-unit townhouse condo-type buildings, but they're not apartment-type buildings. He's looking to match that density and sort of that level of income.
Okay, appreciate that. So question for CPD then, I'm going to ask you the same question. You know, have you had those conversations, or has CPD taken this into consideration when looking at this rezoning?
You know, we always encourage them that once they have a design to work with, you know, CPD development services, because typically we have, you know, for units that are underneath the threshold of 10 units, for example, when we're talking about mandatory housing, you know, they're paying in lieu fee. So we, they, you know, other types of zoning, will, if they're providing a percentage of affordable housing, either that's like the 10%, for example, we'll get the height incentive. So this type of zoning doesn't do that because the unit count is so much smaller. So we always encourage them to like look into the neighborhood and consider what's happening around them. For these smaller scale rezonings, sometimes we don't do an equity analysis because they're so small, and so we don't share like what's happening in the neighborhood, but we try to have them reach out to the council member, reach out to the RNL, so they have a better idea of what's going on in the neighborhood.
Okay, really appreciate that. I guess I find it a little bit concerning. I know that legally speaking, we don't have a lot of leg to stand on at this time, which is why all the council members who were involved in the Near Southeast Area Plan feel pretty strongly that we come up with a legal framework for this. But I will just say, I agree that this zoning seems reasonable given what's going on here, but I am concerned that without that legal framework, we continue to find ourselves in a situation where we see projects that are, you know, that fit the criteria, but also continue to perpetuate this gentrification that we're seeing across our city. So really appreciate that. Really appreciate the conversation. I have no problems with this moving forward at all. Just wanted to ask that question. Thanks.
Thank you, Council. All right, final call for anyone to get in queue. I do not have questions myself, so I will need a motion and a second to move to the floor.
So moved.
Thank you. Motion by Torres, second by Alvidrez. Appreciate this, and we'll see you some Monday night coming soon. Thanks, Edson. All right, and now we have something very exciting, a non-action item presentation from CASR on a study that they put together. It's been a while since they started it, regarding green social housing. And while they're getting up here, I will say I hope Councilmember Lewis makes it back, because this was at her impetus, I think, during the first budget that we all were part of, maybe the second one. I think the first one. All right. Do you guys want to introduce yourselves and then you can take it away? I see your slides are up.
Yeah, well, thank you. So I'm Shelby Summer, Director of Planning and Engagement at Brendel Group. We are a consulting firm with a mission to accelerate equitable solutions to the climate crisis. And so we're a part of the on-call stable of consultants that support CASR on a periodic basis. And so we're talking about a study that was completed last spring, so spring of 2024.
Mm-hmm. I'm Paulina Somoza, a planner for Brendel Group, who led a lot of the case study research for this project in particular.
Thank you. It's very overdue for us to be getting this presentation. I'm so glad you guys are here.
Yeah. So we'll just acknowledge that some of the information is a little bit dated. We haven't refreshed all of the financial information in particular, but a lot of the main facts related to the case studies and the overall findings are still very relevant. So we started this work with CASR, CPD, and the host team in a real collaborative nature. Some of them are over here on the side and here to answer questions as well. And so we're really looking at focusing in on understanding within the context of the affordable housing gap that exists in Denver, what are some of the best practices and what are some examples of sustainable housing that is also affordable? And so we looked at various criteria and really honed in on some various kind of ideas, opportunities to really focus in on in a short period of time, you know, what are some things that Denver can look to for examples? And so in looking at the various criteria, we divided it into three different pillars. These are, you know, pretty typical sustainability pillars. First of all, we were looking very squarely at energy efficiency and renewable energy that extended then to water use and water efficiency, water quality, as well as the embodied carbon associated with waste and materials, et cetera. Not to be outdone by the amazing case studies and things that we were starting to see in the social services and support services arena as it relates to affordable housing. So we also started looking at things that best practices and projects were doing as it relates to family and child support. We heard about technology access and training earlier, food, gardens, education, et cetera. And then finally, we were layering in, like, what are some of the best and kind of challenges related to both location, unit type, unit sizes, as well as different types of affordability thresholds, as well as kind of the stories, you know, a timber versus a steel frame construction that adds to the different cost complexities. So Pauline is going to talk about sort of the research at hand, and then we'll go into some of the findings.
This is a very condensed slide of all the case studies that we took a look at. So the timeline for this started, research began May 24 and went on to about end of April of last year. That began with a literature review of six articles to kind of guide what criteria should we look for when we talk about sustainable, affordable housing and what we should be basing this, our findings on. In total, we ended up reviewing 29 case studies, identifying things regarding design, sustainability, and the factors, identification factors that Shelby just went over. Of those 29 case studies, we identified 10 specific case studies to do a deeper dive on and look a little bit more into the overall aspects when we look at the construction costs and financing opportunities for those case studies in particular. Just to give a brief overview of what that deep dive looked like, we chose one of the case studies, which is Los Vecinos, located in Chula Vista in San Diego, which is the largest city. So trying to match the profile of Denver in regards to the needs of the community, but also how dense that city is. For this particular case study, construction was completed in 2019. That is something I want to know in reviewing the case studies, and a lot of the range was between that 2019-2021 construction completion, so none of it was really completed 2024 at the time of the research that was conducted. For that case study in particular, the design, it was an abandoned motel, so it was reconstructed and replaced by this development in particular, all with materials that were recycled, and 50% of that construction debris was actually recycled as well. So you saw that sustainability aspect incorporated at the start, as well as during the construction phase of the development. For sustainability factors, they had a rooftop photovoltaic system, which was a pretty big win for this development in particular when it comes to energy efficiency. A lot of hydronic space heating, so when it comes to comfort in the home, that was prioritized as well. And then the big thing was that upgraded envelope insulation, which you will see throughout other case studies, was the high performance airtight ceiling. And permeable concrete traps. A little bit more details on the social services, which is what really brought this together, since it was a public-private collaboration between the city of Chula Vista and the private developer. So they have a public art building program where they give actually education to residents there, free of cost on art and its connection to nature, along with some bilingual LEED training, which is also free of cost to residents there at the time of 2019. And then ongoing educational opportunities for children and adults regarding outdoor spaces. And then an extensive recycling program. So again, you see that sustainability aspect throughout the development and even after construction was completed. Awesome. And then for some quick initial findings, not of that particular case study, but looking at all 29, we saw 52% of those developments be all electric. 90% were renewable or incorporated a renewable aspect into their project. And then 79% with that high performance envelope category integrated within their construction. And then 62% considered water savings. All of that can be to the type of landscape that was incorporated and their infrastructure in general, and then 58% incorporated heat pumps. Five projects focused on water reuse, mostly rainwater. 28% of that, again, that high performance envelope or passive house certification is one thing that was brought up a lot. And then 20 of the case studies were within transit-oriented development areas. And then 48% of that development were all family-friendly is what we're calling it, so more than three units and And then for the social supportive services, we looked at a lot of childcare, healthcare, enhanced mobility options, career counseling, some connection to other city services, along with some really out of the box innovative services that were provided to the residents themselves. And before I review the initial findings and costs, I do want to start with that disclaimer that at the time, this was done in 2024, so we have already seen some federal funding that has been impacted by the current administration. So a lot of this has changed. That's the point that we want to make before we review the numbers in specific. So when this was done, there were 74 financial opportunities that can be done at a state or federal level in terms of looking at grants and tax IRA rebates and things like that. 13 programs from here were funded looking at specifically sustainable development. So not just that affordable aspect, but layering in the sustainability portion of it. And then the average cost was about $299 per square foot, and at the time, the Colorado was a little bit more expensive than that, but, and again, the IRA funding for this has changed, but 60% of the projects would be funded on average.
Okay, so what does this all mean, and what are our takeaways from this? One of the key trends, and it was something we were specifically looking for, but were sort of validated through looking at all 29 of these case studies, was the passive house criteria and standards. So some of these affordable housing developments are formally certified as passive homes. A lot of them are using it as sort of inspiration and as a design guideline. And I know Denver's Green Building Code already has a nod to the passive house certification, but we think this is an area that there's a lot of opportunity to continue to lean into. The cost differential compared to some other green building technologies is a lot more manageable and not as steep. And the certification process, if folks choose to go there, isn't as onerous as, you know, like a LEED, for example. We are seeing a lot of momentum in the sort of net zero ready to all electric construction. Some of that is driven by standards and building codes adopted by the communities where these projects were built. In the West in particular, or colder climate, there is just a push towards all electric construction now that the heat pump technology has really kind of been proven to work in colder climates. As Paulina noted, the unit size variance is a notable thing that we're seeing across the board. A lot of affordable housing historically has been a studio or a one-bedroom unit, and we're now seeing two, three, four bedrooms to make room for multi-generational families or larger families or non-traditional kind of living units and structures. Kind of related to that is just this accessibility forward design. And so traditionally accessibility has looked like, you know, ramps and elevators to accommodate physical abilities and needs. But some of the things that we're starting to see are noise and soundproofing, sort of rooms for light sensitivity and different communication styles. And so that's just a trend to watch and really be thoughtful about how to design for the needs of all different people. And then these last two around nonprofit partnerships and co-locating. Denver's already seen a lot of this, but many of the case studies were integrating the thoughts around food access, healthcare, and partnerships with support services at the design, whether it's a new construction or a renovation, really having those partners involved in identifying what goes where and not just bringing them after the fact into a space that's maybe not adequately set up for that support service need. So moving back over to the financial side of things, again, this is kind of old information, but I just wanted to sort of highlight that the Inflation Reduction Act did open up some new pathways for direct funding for nonprofit organizations. So previously you had to kind of partner with another entity in order to receive tax credits because nonprofit organizations clearly aren't paying taxes. And so this direct pay provision is still in effect. That hasn't changed. We'll see if that changes, but that's in the tax code. Some of these tax credits themselves are, you know, ebbing and flowing and changing on the daily. I think there is a window of opportunity as it relates to some of these energy tax credits, particularly geothermal, some of the battery storage, where the phase out timelines, it had been 2035, that's getting accelerated up to 2026 or 2028, depending on which source and which day you're looking at it. But there is a window of time where some of these incentives are still going to be available. So for projects that are sort of in the planning process, we don't want to scratch these off the list entirely. There are still opportunities to pursue these and really beneficial as it relates to some of the things we talked about, zero energy ready and also building for resilience. Okay, and so some final recommendations. Again, this is a little bit dated and recognizing that there's a lot of work that's been done in this space, but we do think that passive home design guidelines or even standards and educational materials are a viable pathway to keep pursuing and keep sort of infusing in the affordable housing arena. There are just opportunities to kind of stack and braid different rebate opportunities. The state, as well as the Denver Regional Council of Governments, are going to be releasing some energy efficiency and renewable energy tax credits in the coming months. And so just aligning local resources with some of these state resources will be beneficial. As it relates to costs, it's complicated. You know, there's a tendency to focus on just the first costs of building things. When we start talking about electrification and renewable energy, it's really helpful to look at the whole life cycle, and specifically the operations costs of the building. Those who pay for the investments don't always you know, reap the benefits in terms of their utility bills, but the costs of different types of energy are shifting with the different energy policies. So it's really does take some long-term forecasting to sort of figure out their return on investment. Some trends to keep an eye on: prefab, whether it's a full sale, all units or pieces of units, parts and pieces, making sure codes are adequately facilitating and enabling that type of development will help accelerate affordable housing development. There are some areas, I haven't done a lot of research on what's changed with the strategic bonus areas for some of the IRA credits. I have a feeling that a lot of that's going away, but there are some areas where there are some bonus credits available or were. And then finally, we talked about partnering with other organizations very early and making sure that the design and that funding portfolio is taking advantage of their needs and addressing those opportunities collaboratively. So I think that's it for us. You all received this report probably about a year ago, so I don't anticipate you have it top of mind. We're happy to send it again if it's of interest. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Well, we've got them, and I will start with Councilmember Lewis for questions.
Okay, thank you. One, I wanted to start with just like thanking my colleagues because you all approved the budget amendment for us to be able to be able to study this, and I'm super excited. And
two
to also
ago.
Thank my brilliant staff, Jesse.
We haven't been in office that long.
Correct. And I just have two really quick questions. So per unit cost is higher for construction, but it's lower for long-term operation. Can you talk about how much cheaper and under what circumstances?
That's a great question. And again, at the time of this case study, a lot of those numbers, we did notice if it was like a public-private partnership. So if that initial cost would be a lot lower if the land was publicly owned versus relying on the private development on things, that drove a lot of it. And then the operational costs, if you have that partnership with a lot of nonprofit organizations to support some of the social services, my initial reaction was saying some of these were too good to be true in terms of like, oh, this is free of cost to the resident. But there was a lot of collaboration when it came to partnering up with the nonprofits. Though that would be like the main takeaways off the top of my head.
Yep, that's it.
Awesome, thank you.
That was a really good question. Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard because this environment keeps changing so quickly, but I'm gonna start and make a comment, I guess, to my colleagues, since we have a little bit of time for that, because having spoken for the last 2 years to Councilmember Lewis about this idea of social housing and what it can mean, the thought that she had behind getting this study funded was kind of brilliant, because when we think about housing, we think about how much it costs people, you know, and then we think about, like, is it accessible? And then maybe we start thinking about, like, is it close to green space? But the point of the term social housing is that because it's publicly owned, all of those values you can, like, make sure are reflected in it, including, you know, the standards to which it's constructed and climate change and all of this. And so it makes a lot of sense if we're good public stewards, if we were to own and operate housing, we should be doing it to good environmental standards, and that has to do both with how things are built and then how they're operated and then how you treat the people inside. So I thought this was a nice way to encompass why that idea is not, it's not just or even mostly a financing model. It's about the idea that publicly owned housing, if we're the ones ultimately in charge of it at the end of the day, is going to be a way to flow through many of our different values and priorities. So sorry, that's just me editorializing, but this study sort of showed me that in ways that I would not have imagined. Like this, the one case study that you pulled out for us on the maybe like fourth slide, those are things that you can tell came from a whole bunch of people involved in this project, bringing a whole lot of really good ideas to bear. And there's this like through line of consistency between how it was built and then how the people in the building continue to have access to like ways to just like live more sustainably. So I thought that was super fascinating. Okay. Now I have to ask some questions. Actually, does anyone else want in the queue? Because I will go last, but I didn't have anyone else in. Okay.
I do have a question.
Good. I thought you did.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it's more of, it's just a question. So Denver Housing Authority, do they have these same sort of standards, or is there conversation with them for their sustainability and kind of how they're implementing, because they are doing
publicly,
like, have a lot of, yeah, you know, a public housing entity. Like, how does that relationship?
That's a great question. I don't know if someone, I don't want to put anybody on the spot. I don't have the answer to that. And I wonder if anyone from any of the agencies who's here has a sense of that. And if not, we'll pin it for a follow-up. Adam. Mr. Lyons, I thought I might see you hopping up over there. Can you introduce yourself?
Good afternoon. Adam Lyons, Deputy Director of Housing Opportunity for HOST. You know, with BHA, and really what's true for most of the rental new construction market, is that they rely on housing tax credits in order to be built. It finances, you know, anywhere between 30 to 50% of the total capital stack. So CHAPA does have very strict standards around green building features and all new development, and they require that any project that gets tax credits to achieve a green building certification, whether that's the Enterprise Green Communities LEED or the National Green Building Standards. So in order to even qualify for credits, you would have to meet one of those requirements. Of course, we have the Denver Green Building Code here as well. So those projects, even though developed by DHA, the same is true for any tax credit developer, that they are following these certifications.
Mm-hmm. Cool, thank you for that. That was a great question, Council Pro Tem. Any follow-up on that?
Just that we continue the conversation, but be able to also, I think, you know, with additional information arising, you know, tide floats all boats, and I would imagine that there's also a very probably strategic conversation that needs to happen with DHA as well.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot. Yeah. And I honestly, Councilmember Lewis or the agencies would probably know this, whether we shared this study with DHA, and yeah, I would be happy to.
I don't think so. But if not, it'd be a great idea.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Yeah. My main issue with DHA, quite honestly, is that we don't govern them. So, you know.
No, you're right. Yeah, we can do it.
Okay, I wanted to ask, could we actually, would you all who are here from the different agencies that work on this, just quickly, we know almost all of you, but introduce yourself and just quickly say what your role was in interacting with this study when it came out, so we know who to go to with future questions.
Sure. I'll go first. Jennifer Ramsey, Planning and Development.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. Come up to the mic. Thank you. I'm a noob chair still. Plus, you all look so comfortable. And Adam, even though I would love to know how you contributed to this, if at all, or just read it when it came out or whatever, but yeah, thanks.
My name is Jennifer Ramsey, Community Planning Development. I'm the Data for Use and Downtown Project Champion. My original role and scope was to assist with the adaptive reuse portion of the study that was subsequently cut due to budget. However, my background is in architecture and is able to contribute more of a market perspective and connect some of the dots regarding some of our state or national pricing data.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Christy Collins. I'm with Community Planning and Development. I lead our small little green communities team within our development services piece. And my role on this was just to come at this from a commercial architect who has focused on sustainability for a very long time, and ask questions and try to fit together the opportunities that we have in CPD and with our codes and our regulations that we're working on with what we were learning through the study, and ask some questions that might help to inform us so that we could do more.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. My name is Matt Rea. I'm actually on the building performance policy team, Sharon's team behind me, but I also manage the on-call contracts, including our friends at Brendel Group, and it was my job to get all these very smart people in the same room and have all these conversations and get momentum on the study. So I was just a facilitator, but believe me, I learned a lot myself.
Thank you.
Sharon Jay, I'm with CASDR and lead the Energize Denver team. I'm actually only here because Liz Babcock is out this week, and I'm here just in case you ask questions. But I wanted to add that there was a lot of things that came up in here that we have some specialists within CASDR, within CPD, within HOST, that if you got all of us in a room, we could talk more about it, like talking about passive house or whether it's a new construction or existing building. I think we could, you know, depending on what your question is and who you want to have in the room, we can provide that.
Could I ask our agency friends to just send us that little like directory of like who connects to this study in different areas of expertise? We would really love that for the whole committee, or probably all of council while we're at it. Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Adam, anything you wanted to add about the study specifically?
Yes, I wasn't too heavily involved in the initial study. We had some folks at Host on the data side that really were involved in setting up a lot of the data. However, my team that I have the pleasure of overseeing at Host is the ones that really feed a lot of this data in. We track our affordable housing developments, really what's getting built and whether they're all electric or not. So we have all of that data available, and a lot of it was did flow into the study.
Okay, thank you. I think my only remaining question, and again, I just want to make sure because I'm chairing that no one else wants in the queue. All right, just checking. This is so interesting, you guys. No, I'm joking.
We're just tired.
We're really tired. I'm going to ask one question, then I'm going to let us out of here early. But I'm wondering, when you talk about our building electrification standards, like we know those are really high, and so we do really well with that in Denver. But I'm curious if through all these case studies, what things stood out to any of you as sustainability elements that either just aren't building code related, or maybe were some small things that are building code related that our code doesn't do. Because I noticed some of that even in the case studies that were kind of highlighted. So I'm just curious about that for anyone who has a thought. And I'm sorry, I know Liz isn't here, but thank you, Sharon.
Sharon Jay with CASR. I think some of the pieces, I like that the funding that these groups get that he was talking about, that you have to do enterprise green communities or one of those other green community standards. I think those are super important. Whether or not our building code does that or not, I'm not positive. I want to leave it to them. I think it was also very interesting that the majority of these were around Passive House, which is a absolutely beautiful design guideline that we are thinking in CASR of how do we incorporate it into the 2026 code, whether it's voluntary as like a first round and then make it a little bit more mandatory, because it's all about tightening up your envelope, which improves energy efficiency, which makes me really happy from Energize Denver perspective. But a lot of the features that they were talking about, I would probably say, you know, maybe 75% maybe are in our code, but these ladies would tell more. But I think there needs to be maybe a little bit bigger effort of like, how do we take the concepts that we learned from this study and apply it to our existing housing, not just new housing? Because I think that we're learning that through Energize Denver, that the more affordable the units are, the more they're behind on deferred maintenance, and then they're in trouble when they get to energy efficiency and having to upgrade their systems for our Energize Denver compliance. And so that really concerns me, but in our compliance assistance program, 75% of the buildings that are in it that are multifamily are their affordable housing. 75% of the buildings that are in our compliance assistance program are affordable housing. And so, like, how do we expand on that? But then also, how do we improve code to make sure that any of the buildings that are built are done in a way that set them up really well for Energize Denver later?
Yeah, great. Yeah. Cool. All right, thank you so much. Did anyone else have an addition to that? Yeah, good, thank you.
So, two thoughts. One, Passive House being highlighted made us really excited, also because of the resilience component of it, because it's energy efficiency, but it's also resilience when there's a power outage.
Right.
People can stay in place a lot longer. Mm-hmm. And so I think we would love to see our codes evolve to promote that more strongly. And then the second thing, going through the case studies and understanding that in different locations and different circumstances, different contributions are possible to the community as a whole, fits with an approach that we have discussed a great deal. We would like to see reflected in our codes that allows projects to take advantage of the opportunities that are unique to the location so that they all contribute towards the community's resilience as a whole. And I think that was reflected through the case studies.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
My perspective is a little bit maybe more market driven, and also my relationships with some of the existing building owners informs my, this is a personal perspective, but there's a price tag associated with every regulation that you add. Passive House is a fantastic standard. It's also can be, you know, that 1 to 11% price increase does mean that rents have to be higher to support that. And if they cannot go higher because of affordability requirements, perhaps those building owners can't maintain the building, and that's why we're having current issues even now. So there's always, you know, a balance of priorities from that respect. Likewise, you know, in at CPD in general, we are trying to streamline approval processes and codes, and there isn't necessarily
a work group that's able to support review and enforcement of those regulations at this point. So if you are considering that as a requirement, we'd want to accommodate that within a budget increase likely.
Yeah, that's super helpful.
Yeah, and I also, noting that it's more expensive to build, but then cheaper energy usage over time, you can't really translate that energy usage savings into making the initial building sort of pencil out. But it is noteworthy to me that that savings, which really hopefully goes to the tenants, comes into play once the thing is actually built. So, okay, we can let all these tired people go unless anyone has any other questions. Thank you. This was phenomenal. Thank you guys all for making the time. Belated, but so amazing. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it. All right. We have one item on consent. If nobody wants to call it off, we are adjourned.
Yep. It's nice to have you.